someone's learning the Baal Shem Tov's Sava. Interesting.
I think one of the Shluchas.
I yelled. We'll see if they come.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I know that, you know, this I still have, this is our last class on the Aguna issue, because I know that some of the people actually, unfortunately, it affects them very emotionally because they went through a divorce, so literally some people felt they couldn't even come. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to keep on talking about it, but I have one more class to cover the main some main things that you want to know about this area. Can we wait another 60 seconds though, then we'll start.
Rabbi,
which advice will you give us when we read the parasha that is very boring?
I'm sorry, which what?
Which
advice?
Yeah.
You know, I'll tell you the truth. There really, really is nothing that's boring when you get into it a little bit. You know, there's something maybe very boring on the surface.
Yes.
So you try to find a commentary. You know, certainly they have. You know, the Rebbe has things on every parsha, different thoughts and that can inspire you. And once you find something that inspires you, then the details even become interesting, because then you try to see that the details themselves support the main point. Sometimes we just want to get the main point, and we don't want to get into the nitty-gritty. But the truth of the matter is, the beauty of a foundational idea is that it actually permeates every single level, even the level of the, what you call the granular detail. So, you know, what can I tell you? You just have to keep at it a little bit. And if you find a commentary or find a sefer in English or Hebrew that just inspires you, so then you can really get into things. Especially the Mishkan, you know, keep in mind, you know, the famous verse. I know that you probably talked about it. Build for me a Mishkan so I will dwell in their midst. Right? So, you know, this famous teaching. Mm-hmm. It's not that God dwells in the Mishkan, but God dwells in our heart and soul. So every detail about the Mishkan is how to make your heart and your soul a Mishkan for the Shekhinah. So then you kind of got to look into it. Well, how does this architectural detail, you know, fit that? You see?
And every single detail that talks about the Mishkan is something about...
Absolutely. Now, I myself cannot give you an answer for every single one, but it's absolutely the case.
Yeah,
that every detail... Well, yeah. So, for example, when we talk about the boards of the Mishkan were supported by sockets, right? Silver sockets, right? So what happened was every board had two teeth, like prongs of a plug, and there were two sockets per board. Do you remember that image? In other words, you have a board, and the board has two teeth coming out like prongs, and each board has two sockets. So each board is being held by two silver sockets. In other words, the sockets are the foundation. Okay? So one of the explanations is that the sockets represent emunah, faith. And that has to be the foundation of your life. But there are two aspects of faith. There is faith in Hashem, and there's faith in you, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave you the ability to achieve great things and not to give up and not to be despondent. And therefore you need the double faith to be your foundation. You know, things like that. You know, all sorts of ideas. Or, for example, the Aron HaKodesh, the Ark. Every one of its dimensions is a fraction. 1.5 by 2.5. It's not a whole number. But when it comes to the table with the bread, some of the dimensions are whole and some of them are fraction. Okay. So the difference is, when it comes to Torah, the Ark represents Torah. You should always feel you're incomplete. You should always want more and more and more. But when it comes to material sustenance, you should feel Hashem gave you everything you need. Right? There's different ideas like that. You know, so everything has an idea.
Thank you.
Thank you. Even when you come, okay, so you're not doing that now, but even when you come to leprosy and all the details, the beautiful, beautiful thoughts and ideas about these things. You know. So that's the that's the issue. The issue is that it's important in life generally, in Torah generally, not to let the trees stop you from seeing the whole forest. But you appreciate the forest when you can also look at the individual trees. Otherwise it just becomes general and, you know, just super superficial by definition. Okay. Alrighty, anyway, have a good evening, everybody. By the way, I just discovered for the first time, I've been teaching here almost 5 years, maybe more than 5 years, that evening classes are optional classes. I didn't know that. I thought this was mandatory.
For some people.
Okay. So I want to congratulate people who, you know, make the effort to go to an optional class at night. That's that's very, very impressive. Okay. All right. Anyway, so this is hopefully this will be the last shiur on this Arguna issue. But there is some important stuff that I want to cover. To be sure that everybody understands the general idea. Last week, what we were trying to show you is three situations where a woman can be released from a dead marriage even without a get, right? That was the common denominator, without a get. And that, of course, when that works, that could be a wonderful release for a woman, because then you don't have to deal with the husband's psychological issues or recalcitrance or blackmail. And just to enumerate, I'm not going to review it in detail, if you remember, the three halachic avenues that a woman could invoke is halachic invalidation of the marriage ceremony, for example, non-kosher witnesses or the like, because once again the answer is very obvious. You only need a get when the marriage is halachically valid. If the marriage is not halachically valid, you don't need a get. And we can sometimes discover, if there was a conservative or reform or a civil ceremony, that it was not halachically valid. In fact, that's very useful, not only in aguna cases, but sometimes a woman didn't get a divorce, simply because they didn't care. No, they were not religious, nobody cared. They got a civil divorce, the woman remarried, had children. If the first marriage is halachic, the second marriage is adulterous, and the kids would be a mamzer. Now, if everybody remains non-religious, nobody cares about that either. But what sometimes happens is, maybe it happened to some people that you know, that the children from a second marriage grow up and they become chozrei b'tshuva, they become religious people, and then, God forbid, they discover that they may have been born from a second adulterous marriage. And if they're a mamzer, that's big trouble. Now, a mamzer is, of course, a Jew. Don't get me wrong. A mamzer is a Jew. And a mamzer can even become a great, great righteous person, but a mamzer does have very severe marital restrictions. But what we can sometimes do, very often do, is we can determine that mom's first marriage was not a halachically valid marriage, and therefore she didn't need a get, therefore marriage number two is not adulterous. Now, it is true that maybe marriage number two is not halachically valid either. But that's not a problem, you see, because even if it's not halachically valid, the worst that would happen is that the kid is born out of wedlock. But being born out of wedlock is not a problem. Let me repeat that. That is why the word mamzer and the word illegitimate child are not synonymous. In the English language, an illegitimate child is any child born out of wedlock. And even the less delicate term, bastard, which I'm just using as a technical term, not as an epithet, means a child born out of wedlock. That is absolutely not true in halacha. Okay, I want to emphasize this. If a child is born out of wedlock, or from a non-halachic marriage, or from an affair, or whatever it is, they have no disability whatsoever. But if they're born from a woman committing adultery when she's halachically married, you have mamzer. But as I say, if we could find halachic irregularities in the ceremony, that's going to prevent mamzerut from the second marriage. Right, so that was method number one, which, again, doesn't always work. This is not a magic bullet, but it works when it works. Okay. Now, number two is kedushei ta'ut, or ta'us, in the Ashkenazic pronunciation. Right? That refers to annulment. That is where we could show that the marriage was based on fraud or misrepresentation. And had the woman been aware of the situation, she never would have consented to the marriage. So the marriage was procured by misrepresentation or mistake. So there is a principle in halacha that she does not need a get because she's not married. A classic example, which unfortunate example, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein has, where a woman marries a man and discovers that he's gay. And he was marrying her just to get respectability or acceptance in the community. Rabbi Feinstein paskened that that is such a basic misrepresentation. And by the way, it doesn't have to be misrepresentation, and even if he didn't intend to misrepresent, but it's such a basic mistake going to the nature of the marriage that she doesn't need a get. Now, this can even apply to all sorts of things, even things that are relatively minor. If he told her, that he had a job, now that maybe it's not such a big deal, and it turned out he was unemployed, he didn't have the job, that is a basis for annulment, because even something like that. Now, here, the big problem is this, though. This is the big problem with the annulment issue. In order to be an annulment, it has to be a problem that predated the marriage. It can't be something that happened later. You see, this is extremely important. So, undisclosed abuse, if he had a criminal record, or if he abused his first wife, and the second wife didn't know about it, that's annulment. But, if he was okay, but he abuses his present wife now, that's a bad thing, and she should get a get. But that's not annulment, because that was not behavior that pre-existed the marriage. Okay, this is a very important difference. Now, some left-wing, modern, Orthodox rabbis, and I don't agree with this, and most poskim do not agree with it, take the position that even bad behavior that's manifested later in a marriage is probably evidence of negative tendencies that must have existed before. So they're willing to apply annulment even to later bad behavior on the grounds that if he's abusing his wife now, there must have been something wrong with him before. Problem with that is that if you take that type of analysis, you never need a get, because every time a woman has bad experiences in the marriage, you can always trace it. Hey, had I known, that he had this propensity. So because of this, according to most poskim, again, there are some that are very liberal in this, but they're not accepted by most rabbis. According to most poskim, annulment is usable, is a remedy, but it only applies to pre-existing undisclosed behavior. It does not apply to things that happen later. Now, another problem with annulment is that if a woman cohabits, continues to live with her husband, after she's aware of the problem, she might waive her right to declare the marriage null and void. So she can still get a get, but she cannot use annulment if she continues to live. Now, that creates a big dilemma when rabbis or psychologists or therapists are trying to encourage a woman to reconcile. But the problem basically is that in the course of reconciling, she may lose her annulment rights, and then to get a get, she's at the mercy of her husband, who may or may not be unreasonable. Right? So that's a real dilemma. If a woman identifies a serious problem, do we tell her, get out as soon as you can? Or do we tell her, try to work it out? Now, again, I'm not talking about abuse. Abuse, generally speaking, there's a debate, but I think many, many people do not recommend that a woman reconcile to abuse, that just for her own safety, for no other reason, she may need to get out as soon as possible. So I'm not referring to that, but let's say other types of misrepresentation, which could be the grounds of annulment. If we encourage, this is kind of a rock and a hard place. If we encourage reconciliation, we may be taking away her right to get annulment if things turn out to be bad. Now, not her right to get a get, but her right to get a get is precarious, because that depends on what the husband does. Annulment, you see, doesn't need the husband's cooperation. I'm sorry, you had your hand up? Did you want to?
Yeah, I was going to ask the case you said about the homosexual.
Yeah.
If a man is homosexual, the only thing that's left for him to do is to actually marry.
Well, this is a very good question. The question is, how does Judaism help the homosexual who genuinely wants to keep the Torah? It is a very good issue. And indeed, let him get married, but he has to get married by disclosing. Now, you may say, well, if he discloses he's homosexual, who's going to want to marry him? Well, a lesbian may want to marry him. No. This is not a joke. In some Hasidic communities, shiduchim are arranged between male gays and female lesbians. And that may sound outrageous to you at first glance, but there's a certain logic to this, because here you have to understand that it is true that they probably will have no sexual expression with each other. That's very true, and that is a major component of marriage.
Well, that's frustrating.
But the thing is that, again, marital intimacy is very important. It is very important, but it's not the only thing in marriage. Marriage can have love, companionship, sharing, working on things together. So at least this creates a mechanism where they can have whatever percentage you want to give, but they can have 60% of what a marriage is. They can have 65%. They can be respected and part of a community. And nobody is being deceived. Nobody is being cheated, you see, because they both know what they're getting themselves into. So here is the point. You're 100% correct that the only thing we can offer a homosexual is this type of marriage, but it can't be through defrauding or cheating.
It has to be open about it.
Has to be open. That's correct. So that's the issue.
Very tough.
It is very tough. Again, this is a real struggle. I don't want to demean it. I consider and say, of course, homosexual expression, it's not inclination. Inclination God does not forbid, but homosexual sexual expression is forbidden. It's an aveira, yeah, and all of that is 100% true, and gay marriage is a travesty and it's prohibited. All of that is true. But lamaisa, we have to have compassion for people that are in that boat and to find a way to help them. Now, as you know, there is something called diversion therapy, which is an attempt to change sexual orientation, but this is an extremely controversial practice. In fact, the state of New Jersey, probably more states, has actually made it illegal.
Thank God.
Well, parents are challenging it as a violation of freedom of religion, because the state of New Jersey...
But the parents are not the ones with the issue.
Okay, I understand. Listen, like everything, there's a mixed record here. I know that in aversion therapy there have been some suicides. I understand that. There are people who have committed suicide as a result of this therapy. I know that. I do know that. On the other hand, I also know, I don't want to prove from anecdotes. Anecdotes don't prove anything. But I do know one married person with children who was, openly gay for many, many years. And he went through this therapy from a now very discredited organization called Jonah, which has been closed down because of many, many allegations against them. But at least, there's at least one case, at least, where he said it was very successful for him. So, who knows? In many ways, there's a catch-22, because, you see, as the gay lifestyle becomes more and more accepted, there's less motivation to change. I mean, again, you're dealing with the idea that people don't change when society says it's okay. But be it as it may, let's factor out aversion therapy. Let's assume that it's not healthy, it's not good, it could create life-threatening tensions and anxiety. Let's make that assumption. So the question becomes, so what's your plan B? Right? What is your plan B? So one plan B is treat homosexuals, lahavdil, the way Catholics treat priests, meaning to say, basically tell the person that, listen, it's very, very sad, and God, has given you this great trial to bear. I don't say great cross to bear. I don't want to use the Christian analogy too much here. But you can devote. You could be married. Just the same language that they use for nuns. You could be married to the Jewish people, so to speak, in terms of chesed. Now, again, it's tragic. It's sad. But all I can say is, I really don't want to sound callous here because it is a real problem, that there are tragedies in life. I mean, there are people who are born, without arms. There are people that have cancer. This is a tragedy. This is a difficulty. It is. But like all difficulties, Hashem expects us to grow from it and find our way. I understand. But in other words, this isn't the only, tragedy that exists in the world. And the third option is this kind of contrived marriage, you know, the lesbian and the gay, you know, and they get together and they create some type of home, a home based on love and companionship. And, you know, there can be strong, as they say, you're getting 65% of whatever percent, you know, I don't know what percentage you put, but there can be deep love between people, even if it's non-sexual love. You know, I don't have the statistics. It has come to my... I have heard that in some Hasidic communities in particular, they do arrange these types of marriages. See, one thing, Hasidim generally, not so much Chabad specifically, I mean, in general, Hasidis like Satmar and the like, they're really into trying to marry off everybody. No, they have a whole controversy. I mean, the state gets involved sometimes. They will marry off, like, severely disabled people with other disabled people. Like two very retarded people, they will marry them off.
What's the point of that?
No, because they say that way. I mean, we're not talking about people who are.
Everyone
momish.
Deserves to have a companion.
Yeah, yeah, and they have love, etc. But of course, they have to live right near. You know, in Hasidic communities, people live right near their parents anyway, so they're kind of people are there all the time. You know, constant babysitting. Whenever they're cooking, somebody's there. You know, so it's a bit of a risk because these are people who bring children into the world. And sometimes the children are, in fact, not disabled. Sometimes they're actually normal. So eventually what happens in a lot of these cases generally is the children, when they get older, take care of the parents, more or less, kind of that way. But that's kind of the general idea in the Hasidic world, that they want to try to give everybody a chance to have love and have a family. And they apply it even in the gay and the lesbian scenario. So but it's a real problem. You know, it's not a simple issue. You know, I mean, halachically it's simple. That's true. Halachically it's not a complicated halacha. But, you know, a spiritual advisor, a rav, a posek, a rebbetzin, whatever it is, has to feel for the real, real dilemma. That, the pain, that halacha doesn't have a solution for all pain, but we still at least have to have the empathy and the compassion to help people over these this pain and this struggle and the like. Okay, now so we mentioned the two things: invalidating the halachic details of the ceremony. That's the first thing. The second thing is ta'ut, kedushei ta'ut, finding a mistake or a misrepresentation. Now the third,
I you said it. So if someone is gay and he married and he said, "I'm gay," after they're married, it's
so this is tricky. If he had already been gay before he was married, that is a basis for annulment, ta'ut. But if he became gay, now this is tricky. Did you become gay? You know, that's part of the problem. If he became gay afterwards, then that's not ta'ut. She can get a get, but it's not an annulment. Now, with gayness, if that's the right word, that's especially a little problematic, especially if you connect gay to a genetic propensity, because one might say, well, you don't become gay. Maybe you discover that you were gay, right? In other words, even people who are married many years sometimes become gay, but in a sense, they'll say that's what they always were. Okay, that's a big problem. But I think, practically, we always encourage a get. So unless he was an active, practicing homosexual before the marriage, I think we would try to get a get to avoid the problem. But I understand that gayness in particular raises the very elusive distinction between pre-marriage problems and post-marriage problems. Okay? Alrighty. Now, the third thing, again, this is a way of review, is the decision of the Beis Din of Tzfat. And if you remember, that involved the fellow in the coma, the unfortunate man that was in a coma for 7 years. And as you could guess, a man in a coma cannot give a get because he's not competent. So what the Beis Din in Tzfat, so basically she had no husband, but she couldn't marry without a get. He was still alive. So what the Beis Din did was, the Beis Din made themselves the shaliach. They appointed themselves as the agent of the husband, and they gave a get without his consent, on the theory that had he been awake for 2 minutes, and had we been able to ask him, "Do you want to free your wife from the bonds of living this way, he for sure would have said yes. So we can, we meaning the Beis Din, can make ourselves shluchim, right, without a direct appointment, if for sure it's something the husband would have wanted. Now this is called get zikoi. Get zikoi. A get that we act for the so-called benefit of the husband, that the husband would want it for sure. Now, this get zikoi is, again, very, 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 very controversial. There was, in fact, there's only one decision that used it. The Beis Din of Tzfat used it. Most rabbis felt it's not a proper thing to do, and in fact, unfortunately, they treat the woman like a married woman still, because their argument is you can't be a shaliach unless the husband appointed you, and you can never make an assumption, well, for sure he would have done it had he been able. There's a difference between the hypothetical, what he would have done, and what he actually did. But I want to point out one important thing that the Beis Din of Tzfat did say. The Beis Din of Tzfat said, even if you accept get zikoi, which they did, that only applies when he's disabled. That does not apply if he's recalcitrant. If he's a bad guy who says, I don't want to give a get, we can't make ourselves a shaliach, because it's clear that he doesn't want to give a get. So it's very important. This is not a solution for the typical aguna problem. The typical aguna problem is, husband says, I'm not giving a get. So the Beis Din cannot say, you see the difference? The Beis Din cannot say at that point, oh, we will be a shaliach of the husband to give a get, because for sure that's what he'd want to do. He says he doesn't want to do it. So they made an important footnote. They said, this is a very, very most important footnote in the opinion, they said that our ruling is limited to a husband who is disabled and never said he wouldn't divorce his wife. So we assume he would like to release his wife from this imprisonment. But when you have a recalcitrant, rebellious husband, then unfortunately that's not going to work. Now, the reason why this is an important note is, once again, some of the modern, progressive, more liberal Orthodox movements have used get zikoi even for a man who doesn't want to give a get by saying, well, in his deep neshama, in his godly soul, he really wants to do it, so we'll be his shaliach. But that's a little improper, because in the physical world, we have to operate with the animal soul as well, and we can't automatically look only at the godly will. We have to look at the animal soul, and if he doesn't want to give the get, we cannot be his shaliach. So you already see that people are distorting the Beis Din of Tzfat, and they're applying it right now. These three methodologies are methodologies which can release a woman without a get. Okay, and the reason why that's very helpful is at that point you don't have to fool around and convince a recalcitrant husband. Okay,
If the husband wakes up and then says, "I would have never done that."
Yep, you got a big problem. The question would be, would that invalidate the get? Or would we say that since at the time this is what it appeared to be, that doesn't get changed by something later? The truth is, I think you're right. I think according to the halacha, if we acted on the assumption that this is what he would have wanted, and we later discover he doesn't want it, then her get is going to be null and void, and this whatever second marriage she has is an adulterous marriage with Mamzer and everything else. So potentially it's a serious problem, but the Beis Din had medical opinions that the husband will not come out of the coma. Now, of course, that doesn't mean anything. He may come out of it. But they operated based on the medical advice that he had been in the coma for 7 years, and it's not likely he will come out of the coma. Although people come out of coma sometimes 20 years, even longer. Yeah.
Are you able to pull a plug on a person?
Well, that would solve the woman, so probably, yeah.
No, I mean...
So that's another question, and we've talked about that, and we'll talk about it again. The basic idea is this. The basic idea is that even people in comas are halachically alive, and you don't have to do what's called extraordinary. So if they go into cardiac arrest, You don't have to give them CPR. If they get cancer, you don't have to give them chemotherapy. Meaning you can withhold treatment, but you cannot actively do something that causes them to die. So turn off a system they're already are on is treated like actively interfering with what's keeping them alive. So that would be murder. So generally speaking, you cannot pull the plug. However, just to remind you, there is a difference, halachically, whether the person is in a coma or the person is brain dead. Now let me explain the difference very quickly. A person in a coma, of course there are different levels of coma, but let's call it persistent vegetative state. So they generally lack consciousness, although they sometimes go in and out. But their brain stem is still functioning. So for example, people can be in comas and breathe normally. Their digestive system, you know, operates, etc. Although obviously they don't take food by mouth, whatever it is. So a person in a persistent vegetative state is 100% alive, and you're not allowed to kill him by terminating life support, although you don't have to do anything to keep him alive. But when a person is brain dead, that's a different stage. That is where the brain stem itself has been destroyed, which means he's not capable of respiration. There is no nervous system that's functioning. If you jab him with a needle, there is no response. If you shine a light in his pupils, they don't respond. And breathing is only because you're pumping a respirator, you know, into him, etc. Now there are some opinions that say a brain-dead person is dead. And even the opinions that say a brain-dead person is not dead say you're allowed to take him off life support and let nature take its course. So what that would mean is that in some cases of advanced coma, if it morphs into brain death, you'd be allowed to pull the plug. But this husband was not brain dead. This husband was in a coma, but Terry Schiavo, do you remember? This was a long time ago already. But Terry Schiavo was in a coma for 15 years. She was not brain dead at all. She was not on a respirator. Terry Schiavo was breathing on her own, even though she was not conscious. So there, for sure, to pull a plug is considered to be an act of murder. So that would not be a solution.
But what if it was in their will?
Well, once again, it would appear to be logically the case that since a person is not allowed to commit suicide, a person is not allowed to authorize that their plug be pulled, because that would be the same as saying, kill me. Now, I can't tell you to kill me because I can't kill myself, you see? Now, if you're asking me legally, this is a big problem. Legally, both in Israel and in America, certainly, all 50 states, a person can have such an instruction, 1,000%, you're 100% correct. And that's going to be a dilemma. If you are a religious person and you have a parent or a relative that has given such a legal instruction, that's called in a living will or the like, or a healthcare directive or an advanced directive, a lot of different names, it's all kind of the same thing. So you're going to have a dilemma, because there will sometimes be instructions that you as a religious person, whether you're a relative or whether you're a doctor, are not allowed to carry out. Okay, so that's going to be that is a problem. But if you're asking me halachically, you cannot just pull the plug on somebody, at least until they reach brain death. And some people in a coma never reach brain death. In other words, sometimes the trajectory of coma is that maybe the person goes into cardiac arrest and dies, but they never actually reach a stage of brain death. The brain does not, the brain stem does not get destroyed. Brain death is commonly, you know, when you have motorcycle accidents or things like that. In fact, organ donation is largely from brain dead people who have healthy bodies. What do they say? They say the ideal organ donor is a teenager that was riding a motorcycle without a helmet. Mm-hmm. Because there what you got is you got a smashed head and a healthy body. And in fact, somebody told me, I think it's kind of a bad taste joke, but they said that when the Pennsylvania legislature wanted to make a mandatory motorcycle helmet law, that you weren't allowed to ride a motorcycle without a helmet, so the organ donor lobby testified against it because they said, seriously? We're going to have fewer people that we can get organs from.
That's crazy.
I have a feeling this
that
is
it wasn't
probably
true.
This is probably an urban legend or something, but that's what they say. But it just shows you conflict of interest, right? Hey, you know, if fewer teenagers get, you know, if get their heads get fewer people heads get their get smashed up, we're going to have fewer organs to save people, right? So we need some teenagers to get killed, you know. Okay. I hope that wasn't the case.
I love those jokes.
I hope that wasn't the case, but that can actually happen. Okay. Now, so today what I want to finish up with is, let's say that none of these three avenues work and the woman needs a get. So how do you get a get from a guy who's holding out for whatever it is, either blackmail, money, custody, property, or sometimes just malice. Sometimes even if you give him $1 million, he's not going to want to give again, right? So what do you do? Obviously, to a large degree, the best thing to do is to be an expert psychologist. I mean, as I say, sometimes the issue is not going to Basin, going to court. Sometimes the issue is just having a heart-to-heart talk with a person, and that can sometimes work, but you need to be skilled. Shaming people doesn't always work. Sometimes it works, but often it backfires and the like. So that's an important thing to know, that sometimes the solution to problems is not more activism, it's sometimes less activism, in which you approach people in a quiet way without embarrassing them. Okay, but putting that aside, let me just mention the following. Once a woman needs a get, you have to know there's a fundamental difference between Israel and the United States. And this is very, very important. In the United States, a woman goes to a Beis Din, and a woman demands a get because the husband abused her, the husband didn't support her, or the husband is a real bad guy, etc., and the husband is refusing to give a get. So let's assume the woman gets a psak. Now, what's the psak? The Beis Din orders the husband to give a get. Wonderful. But here's the problem. The Beis Din ordered the husband to give a get. Well, what if he just doesn't do it? In other words, what does, in the United States first, let's say, in the United States, what does it mean? It's like they used to say, you know, a psak Beis Din, and how much does a coffee at Starbucks cost? Or whatever.
$4.
Like they said, with the psak basin and $4, you can get a coffee at Starbucks. You know, meaning, what does a psak basin give a woman? Because remember, here's the problem in the United States. The psak of a basin is not enforceable. So if the husband is a righteous guy, he'll listen to the basin. But if he'd be a righteous guy, he would give her a get without going to basin. So obviously he's not a righteous guy. So what's going to make him give a get? So there are a few things. In the United States, once you have a psak Beis Din, you can put the husband's name in the Jewish press, and you can embarrass him, you can shame him, but that doesn't always work, as I say. Many synagogues have a policy that if a man refuses to give a get, if a Beis Din ordered him, that's important, until the Beis Din orders him, he's not a sinner. They can deny him coming to the shul, they could deny him coming to a bar mitzvah, a family simcha, his own child, no aliyah, etc. Now they can. I'm not saying every shul does, but many shuls do have a policy that a man who refuses to give his wife a get after a Beis Din so directed is not welcome, will be denied synagogue honors, he could even be excommunicated.
It happens often?
It doesn't happen that often. What happens basically is because Yiddishkeit in America, really all over the world, is so decentralized. So some shuls will side with the wife, some shuls will side with the husband, and some shuls will say, oh, that Beis Din is corrupt, we don't listen to that Beis Din. So if the husband gets kicked out of one shul, he'll go two blocks away to another shul. But in theory, once there's a psak Beis Din, there can be excommunication, there can be shaming.
Can they beat up the guy?
Yes. Now the other thing is, according to Halacha, and be sure you understand this. Once there's a psak Beis Din, not before, but once there is a psak Beis Din, physical force can be used to beat up the person. And that is totally legitimate. Once, only once there is a psak Beis Din. That's very important.
Torture him?
Now, he can be tortured.
Is that legal in Israel?
Okay, no, well, let me talk about America first. Let me explain. Now, the issue in America is this.
That's not legal.
It is not legal. And in fact, there are presently two rabbis in America, two very fine rabbis, I know them both, who are in jail because of they were convicted of torturing a person in order to give a get. Now, basically, these are two rabbis who convened Beis Dins, and they said they would, once they had the Beis Din render the appropriate decision, they would effectively torture people by electric cattle prodding and good old Iraqi torture and the like. And the FBI, it's interesting how the FBI entrapped them. The FBI got a woman. It's amazing what the FBI does. The FBI got a woman, an agent, to pose as a religious woman who needed a get.
Poor agent.
And the agent comes in and says, my husband doesn't want to give me a get, and all this is being, she's secretly recording everything. And they say, well, okay, well, we have our ways to get a get, you know, we'll tie the guy up and waterboard him and all of those different things. So they got arrested. They got arrested for blackmail or extortion, whatever the crime is. And they are presently in jail. So halachically, it's absolutely valid. It is absolutely valid. But legally, it can result in imprisonment. And besides that, you also have to raise this issue that it's not just the fact that it's not nice to go to jail. I certainly wouldn't want to go to jail. But there's also called Chilul Hashem, because people read about religious Jews engaging in torture of other people, even though the people they're torturing are lowlifes and, you know, maybe not so deserving of compassion. But sometimes, I hate to say it, sometimes you have to let the aguna suffer, at least in terms of this way, if the other way would be a Chilul Hashem of massive proportions. Now, let me move to Israel. Israel is a very, very different situation. And the reason Israel is different is that in Israel, the rabbinical courts are part of the state judiciary. The rabbinical courts in Eretz Israel are actually government courts. And that means, therefore, if a Beis Din in Eretz Israel paskens that a man must give a get to his wife, that is a legally enforceable judgment. That means in the state of Israel, a man can go to jail for not giving a get to his wife. Not in America. In the state of Israel, they have lesser sanctions as well. A man can have his passport suspended, his driver's license revoked, his wages garnished, you know, frozen. So the big difference in Israel and America is, in America, a Beis Din is a religious court. And because of what's called the separation of the church and state, which is the Constitution of the United States, a Beis Din says something, a secular court is not going to force the person to do it. In the state of Israel, the religious Beis Din is actually an arm of the state. And therefore, in Eretz Israel, you would think that a woman has much more recourse to, she can get her husband in jail, etc. But let me point out, this is not a panacea. Because when people are acting out of malice, sometimes they would rather stay in prison. There was a story in the Newsweek magazine, which is now defunct, around 15 years ago, about a man who remained in jail 22 years without giving a get to his wife. And he died, so eventually she was released from him. But she was already like 70, she was 75 or whatever it was. Another thing to keep in mind is that in Israel, some of the agunot are married to people in prison already. I mean, so some of the women who want to get in, their husbands are in jail. So what are you going to do? Now, theoretically, the Knesset could pass a law allowing for physical torture, because halachically that would be permitted. And some rabbis have recommended that the Knesset pass a law. See, right now, the maximum punishment in Israel for not giving a get is imprisonment. And that doesn't work if the guy not giving a get is already in prison for life, life sentence. Some of them are. Now, theoretically, halacha would permit torture. But the state of Israel does not permit torture. So, we don't have that. Some have suggested, okay, that if the recalcitrant husband is a Haredi, is a religious person, this is very interesting, he not be given glad kosher food in prison. In other words, we take away...
Starve him?
Well, not starve him, but they'll give him bread and water, or they'll give him plain rabanut, which for Haredi is like treif.
Yeah, but they'll eat
you know, this. You'll eat rabanut or, you know, or give a get. They'll for sure give a get, right? Anything but that, right? So people are suggesting that, at least for the more religious husbands who are withholding a get, perhaps we could take away some of their religious... services or whatever it will be, which is actually legitimate, you know, because after all, we're not stopping him from doing mitzvahs. If he gives a get to his wife, he'll be able to do all the mitzvahs. It's really his decision.
In Israel, in prisons, do they get time to daven?
Yes, they do. They do. They do. It's not good to be in prison, but Israeli prisons are very accommodating of religious. Yes, of course. Yeah. But again, the basic kosher is rabbanut. They don't necessarily give mahadrin. But if you have a Haredi person in prison for draft evasion or whatever it is, they give him mahadrin as well. So the recommendation was that maybe if he's not giving a get, don't give him mahadrin food and put those types of pressures on him and the like. In fact, this is what they said with terrorists. I mean, lahavdil. I mean, I don't want to compare any Jew to a terrorist. But one of the things that to break down terrorists, they say, like, give him pig or give him chazer or something, you know, because for a Muslim, it's... It's really a horrendous thing. Or they say, what do they say? They say if you bury a Muslim with a pig or something,
he doesn't go to
Gan Eden, he doesn't go to paradise. So that's not true for a Jew, by the way. A Jew is not affected. I mean, it's a humiliation, but Baruch Hashem, a Jew is not, his ultimate destination is not affected by something like that. But for the Muslims, that's a big, big deal. So some were saying that any terrorist who dies, any suicide bomber, you know, we're going to bury him with a pig or something, and that would be a way that they would actually be afraid to participate in those activities.
Murder a bunch of pigs.
Well, PETA, PETA would be concerned about that, you know. But if necessary, it would be for a good, beneficial purpose. Okay. So in the state of Israel, women have much more protections simply because legally the psak of a Beis Din is an arm of the state. And this is true, by the way, just a little bit, you know, if any of you, hopefully, you know, you'll be getting married soon, or, you know, or whenever is the right time for you, and, you know, you'll be given a choice to register with the Rabbanut Beis Din or the Eda Charedis Beis Din. Are you familiar with some of these convolutions? Okay. The Rabbanut is the official state system of rabbinical courts. Now, the ultra Charedim to the right don't recognize the state of Israel. So as a result, they would never register marriages with the Rabbanut because they don't recognize the Rabbanut. So we have what is called...
Does the Rabbanut
accept? That's what I'll get to you. So we have what is called the Eda Charedis. That's the Badats, right? They certify food, right? They're the best hashkacha on food. But they also have a whole Beis Din system for marriage and for divorce. And you can decide to register with the Eda Charedis Badats instead of the Rabbanut. But what's interesting is that although the Eda Charedis doesn't recognize the state of Israel, it's almost like two foreign countries. They have a treaty in which each Beis Din will recognize the marriages and divorces of the other. It's almost like a treaty. It's like a treaty between two, because otherwise it would be too much of a mess, right? So technically, the Eda Charedis doesn't recognize the state of Israel at all, but they will kind of have, you know, we'll accept the marriages and divorces of one group to the other group. So you can have a choice to do Eda Charedis or Rabbanut, but either way, you will be recognized. I think the Eda Charedis is a little less bureaucratic. They're a little less into paperwork, so some people find it a little easier to go to the Eda Charedis. But Eda Charedis only works with very religious people. So if you're a secular Israeli, you know, you'll only go to the Rabbanut and the like. So if you go to the Eda, be sure you dress extra tzniyas, etc. And then hopefully you will be able, right? You will be able to take care of it through the Eda Charedes. Okay, so the Eda Charedes is again it dates back. It's a very interesting history. The Eda Charedes dates back to before the founding of the State of Israel, and it was started in opposition to Zionism. The Eda Charedes was against pre-1948. They were against the establishment of the state of Israel. They thought it would cause war, which of course actually it did, caused many wars, and they were in favor of maintaining some type of British, they liked the British mandate, actually. They would have kept the British mandate going and the like. In fact, the founder of the Eda Charedes was a very, very great and famous rabbi, you may have heard, Rav Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld. And his ideological opponent was Rav Kook. Rav Kook was the first Zionist rabbi, chief rabbi of Israel, and Rav Sonnenfeld was the Eda Charedes. And although they were very, very good friends, but they were ideological opponents, and unfortunately their disciples became enemies. That was the problem.
What does it mean, Eda Charedes?
Eda Charedes literally means the religious congregation. Yeah, so Eda Charedes. The word Charedes means... actually, Charedim actually means Quakers. Charedim means those who shake and tremble in the presence of God. That's what Charedim means. So it means Quakers. That's exactly it. You quake, you shake in reverence to God. That's exactly right. So we have Jewish Quakers in Israel. Okay. You know, there's the actually there are two movements. There's the Quakers and the Shakers. If you're the Shaker, the Shakers, it's also a very extreme Christian movement. But they have a little bit of a problem. They have celibacy, and I think they don't accept converts. So it's a little difficult to figure out how do you continue? How do you continue a movement? How do you continue? They have some way. Once in a while, they accept converts every 10 years or something. But they remain very, very small, obviously. But okay, alrighty. Now let me just mention though that even in Israel, there is a significant problem. Problem number one is that if the maximum sanction is imprisonment, some people are willing to go in prison, or some people are in prison.
How do you
raise
a child?
Say again,
huh? No, I'm just saying, how can someone raise a child that turns into a monster like that? It blows my mind, whatever.
Well, you know...
It's not so hard.
You can't blame the mother, but...
You can't blame the mother. You know, I just read... this is apropos... This is apropos of nothing, but it struck me. You know, I was reading... This is a very, very amazing thing. Hitler... Yimach Shemo v'Zichro, actually saved one Jew. There was one Jew that he gave a direct order that nobody can touch, and this Jew be allowed to emigrate to America with all of his money, etc. And this was the doctor who took Hitler's mother died of cancer, and it was a Jewish doctor that took care of her in her last months. And Hitler said, "This is the good Jew. There's one good Jew.
There's one good Jew in the world."
Now it's interesting that the doctor came to New York. The doctor lived for 20 years in Washington.
It's like the opposite of Saul and Melech.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. He was a Jewish doctor. He came to New York in 1935 or whatever, and he lived for another 20 years. And he described Hitler's mother. He said Hitler's mother was a very, very refined, kind, considerate person. Now you then ask, so how do you get a son like that? The short answer is you can't really blame them. You know, you can't always blame the mother. You can't always blame the parent.
No, and Hitler had so many Jewish friends. They say his art dealers and all his friends. His best friend was Jewish.
Well, you know, there is a recurring rumor that
he was Jewish.
Well, that, number one, he had Jewish blood. Number one, he was hardly the Aryan, the blonde, blue-eyed Aryan for sure. And number two, that he had a Jewish girlfriend. There is a recurring rumor that he was jilted by I hope that wasn't the case, that some Jewish woman caused this. But he was jilted by a Jewish woman, and he got
fanatically
crazy.
What did you say after you said his name?
Oh yeah. Yimach Shemo v'Zichro means may his memory and name be erased. That's what we say about Haman and people like you never. Some people say it about Jews. They disagree with you. You should never say it about a Jew. You never say Yimach Shemo v'Zichro about Jews. Okay, but Hitler, they say. So all I'm saying is that
what if he was a Jew?
Oh well, okay. But I mean, I think.
But you say that about Yeshka.
Okay, I think there are exceptions. Meaning someone who murdered 6 million Jews, or someone that created a whole religion of idolatry. That's kind of different. But you don't say. But sometimes people say it about, you know, anti-Zionists say it about Zionists. You don't talk that way about a Jew that way, even if the ideology is, you know, you wouldn't even say it about the reform movement or something like that. Okay, all righty. Now here is the thing. There is another problem, though, and that is, yes, let's go back to Israel. In Israel, once you have a psak based in, there are many things we can do to a man. Put him in jail, take away his passport. But the question is, how does a woman get a psak based in? What does she have to show? In other words, she needs a psak that orders the husband to give a get. When will they order it? Like, what does a woman have to show to get that order? Because without that order, nothing else is going to happen. So here, let me explain that there's a big, big fundamental argument that goes all the way back to the Middle Ages, and it's based on the Gemara, which is much earlier. And this is a machlokas between the Rambam and Rabbeinu Tam. The Rambam you've heard of, or Moshe ben Maimon. Rabbeinu Tam is Rashi's grandson. Why is he called Rabbeinu Tam? It's very interesting. Rashi, as you know, had no sons. Rashi had daughters. But Rashi's daughters were very learned as well, but Rashi's grandchildren became very great rabbis. And perhaps the greatest was named Rav Yaakov. And Rav Yaakov is like Yaakov Avinu, was described in the Torah as Ish Tam, a perfect person. So they called him our teacher, the perfect one, Yaakov. So Rabbeinu Tam. Now, the Rambam says the following. The Rambam has something that I think feminists would applaud. The Rambam says, if a woman goes to Beis Din, and a woman simply says, I can't stand living with my husband anymore, the Beis Din will order the man to give a get. She doesn't have to prove he did anything wrong. She doesn't have to prove he beat her. She doesn't have to prove he abused her. All she has to say is, I don't want to live with him anymore. And the Rambam's language is, because a woman is not a maidservant or a slave, that she can be forced to remain in a marriage that she does not want to be in. So according to the Rambam, it would actually be very, very easy for a woman to get a psak beis din, because all she has to say is, I don't want it. However, Rabbeinu Tam, and again, these are not just made up positions. You understand, when I say there's a machlokas A and B, it ultimately goes back to how you interpret a Talmudic discussion. It's not like just, you know, made up stuff. Rabbeinu Tam sharply disagrees with the Rambam. And Rabbeinu Tam's argument is the following. It is not philosophically proper in a Torah worldview to allow marriages to be terminated by simply saying, I don't want to be in anymore. Because after all, perhaps the woman is saying it because she's attracted to another man, whatever it would be. And therefore Rabbeinu Tam says that a woman is not entitled to get a get unless she has strong substantiation and a reasonable objective ground. So that would mean she would have to show abuse. Now, even that's a big question. Physical or even emotional? What is abuse? Right, abuse. I mean, the husband yelled at me once because I was a little late. You know. What is abuse? That is a difficult question. But things like abuse, non-support, abandonment, refusal to cohabit. These are types of grounds. Now, practically speaking, the Batei Din, both in America and in Israel, and maybe it's unfortunate, do not follow the Rambam's view. They follow Rabbeinu Tam's view. As a result, it is not so easy for a woman to get a psak beis din, because how does a woman prove different things? Now, sometimes proof might be easy, but often issues like emotional abuse, especially, might be he said, she said type of thing. And if she can't prove it to the satisfaction of the Beit Din, she will not get her psak. And if she doesn't get her psak, all of those wonderful things that we can do for her are not going to be activated, because the key to activation, the ignition, so to speak, is the Psak Beis Din. Now, it's interesting, I don't want to get too personal or editorializing here, that in some ways, this is where the judges, the Dayanim, are influenced by their cultural milieu. Let me give you a bit of an example. In the old Sephardic traditions, certain ways that women were treated were considered to be appropriate, which were not appropriate among Ashkenazim. So, for example, Sephardim in Islamic countries occasionally engaged in legitimated wife hitting. Like, what is the, she was only hit if she deserved it, type of thing. So as a result, if a woman comes and says, "My husband's hit me," there are some Dayanim that say, "Well, if he didn't do it that often, you know, it's not such a bad thing." So there is a bit of a disconnect between what is considered to be tolerable behavior and what is intolerable. So that is why there's actually a program in place for Dayanim, in addition to the learning of halacha, to meet with, you know, sociologists, or social workers, therapists, psychologists, to try to understand the milieu and the culture. You see, this is a complicated question, because what is abuse is kind of a function of what is considered to be normal in society, and that can change with time. See, this is always a complicated problem, because on one hand, the Torah is eternal, the Torah is non-changing. On the other hand, certain aspects of it are going to be affected by what is considered to be decent and acceptable at any given moment in time. So there actually is an educational process that Dayanim need to go through, going beyond the halacha, to understand what is abuse. But the point I want to make is that it's interesting statistically that there are differences geographically. Maybe different judges have different Dayanim have different perceptions. In Yerushalayim, when women file for get, only around 5% of the time will they get an order ordering the man to give a get. Meaning 95% of the time they will not rule in favor of the woman, although maybe the husband gives a get anyway. You know, you really can't show. In other words, 5% of the time they will order him. Now, what happens the other 95%? That doesn't mean she doesn't get a get, but it means they work through negotiation. In Tel Aviv, it's a much higher percentage. It's like 30%. Now, why is that a difference? Is it because the Dayanim in Tel Aviv are more feminist? They understand it more? Or are the husbands in Tel Aviv more abusive? It could be the opposite way. Right? So there is... one cannot deny that when you're dealing with what is called abuse, what is called abandonment, these are halachic concepts, but the halacha does not... I hope I'm not sounding like a reform rabbi here.
What is abandonment? Exactly?
Abandonment is when a husband rejects his wife, refuses to be with his wife, etc. But what is called abandonment, what is called abuse, is not always totally objective. It requires looking at what is normal behavior. And normal behavior changes with time, you know? So this is a big issue. But be it as it may, so I think we can safely say that once a woman gets a Beis Din decision in Israel, she is much better off than a woman that gets a Beis Din decision in America. That's very true. But it is not so easy to get a Beis Din decision either in Israel or in America. Now, if we followed the Rambam, it would be very easy. But as I say, the halachic system does not follow the Rambam. Now, there are writers who have started to ask, well, why can't we go back and follow the Rambam's view? And that would give women a Psak Beis Din. But still, it's very hard to turn the clock back, because the Shulchan Aruch, more than 500 years ago, rejected the Rambam's view. And therefore, it's very, very difficult to say that we're going to not follow the Shulchan Aruch and go back to the Rambam. Certain matters become closed, and you can't automatically revisit. And by the way, that's highly unusual, because the Shulchan Aruch almost never rejects the Rambam. It's very amazing that this is the specific case where the Shulchan Aruch does not follow the Rambam's view. Okay, so now let me mention something else. And that is, in the United States, there is something that people sign called a prenuptial agreement. These are agreements that you sign before a marriage. And they serve different purposes, but one of the purposes they serve is to encourage a get if there's a marital breakdown. Now, there are different types of prenuptial agreements. I'm going to mention a prenuptial agreement that was prepared by the Rabbinical Council of America, and that's an organization of 900 rabbis, the largest Orthodox rabbinical organization in the United States, maybe in the world, and it's abbreviated RCA. So if you ever hear RCA, this is the RCA prenup. You can actually get a copy of it. You go to the RCA website and you can actually get this prenuptial agreement. Some rabbis insist on it. Some rabbis have a policy. They will not marry a couple unless the couple signs this prenuptial agreement. Other rabbis will refuse to marry a couple if they sign this prenuptial agreement. They will specifically not allow it to be used. And I'll explain the differences. And some rabbis, like myself, are kind of milquetoast on this, meaning to say, if you want it, we'll do it, and if you don't want it, you know, I don't really care. So they don't insist one way or the other. I'll explain the three different views on this. Now, what does the RCA prenuptial agreement say? It basically has two parts. Part one and part two. And actually, these are two different agreements. You can do part one without part two, and you can do part two without part one. Or you can do both parts. Part one says the following. The parties agree, meaning husband and wife agree, that in the event we decide to terminate our marriage, we will go to a Beis Din, and they actually are supposed to name the Beis Din. We will go to the Beis Din. The RCA Beis Din is called the Beis Din of America.
I download it here if you want to read.
Okay, yeah. Well, I'm familiar with what it says, but okay. So you can see it. You can see it right there. That the parties agree to go to a Beis Din, and they pick the Beis Din. Now, the RCA Beis Din is called Beis Din of America, and they pronounce it Beth Din, B-E-T-H. D-I-N of America. They're in Manhattan, but you can pick another Beis Din, and we simply agree to go to a Beis Din and obey their decision. Now, what does that do? What is the purpose of that? So let me explain what that does legally. In America, this is for America. In America, this is very important, because I had mentioned before that the problem in the United States is that even if a Beis Din orders a man to give a get, they can't enforce their decision. And if the man just says no, there's no big deal. But this agreement creates a legal enforcement. Because when you agree to go to a Beis Din, what you've done legally is you've agreed to go to arbitration. Arbitration is when you go outside of a court to resolve a dispute. No, there's arbitration, nothing to do with a Beis Din. You know, in labor disputes, if there's a union, you go to arbitration. NFL, you know, baseball, football players, they go to arbitration. Well, the same way you can go to a secular arbitration panel, you can agree to go to a Beis Din to arbitrate. Now, here's the thing, though. When you sign an arbitration agreement, a secular court can force you to go to the arbitrator and to obey the arbitrator's order. So, without the agreement, the man could just refuse to go to Beis Din. Or even if he goes to Beis Din, he'll refuse to obey the Beis Din. But once he signed the arbitration agreement, the woman can now go to a, let's say, any court, New York State Court, Connecticut Court, Virginia Court, California Court, and the husband will be ordered to go to a Beis Din, and if he doesn't, he can go to jail in the United States. And if the Beis Din orders him to give a get, the Beis Din orders him to give a get, not the secular court, the secular court can order him not to give a get, but to obey the decision of the Beis Din. So what the RCA agreement essentially does is, it turns the American Beis Din, you don't need an agreement like that in Israel. In Israel, the decision of the Beis Din is already legally enforceable. In America, the decision of the Beis Din is not legally enforceable, but by the arbitration agreement, we have made it legally enforceable. See, that's why an agreement like that is totally unnecessary in Israel. There's nothing the agreement accomplishes that is not already inherent in the system. Does everyone understand the purpose of that, of part A, part one of the RCA? So it's essentially, it's called an arbitration agreement. And at least in New York, I mean, not all courts, not all states have ruled upon it, but New York State has ruled that forcing a person to go to a Beis Din as part of an arbitration agreement is not a violation of separation of church and state, because the court is not interested in religion. The court is simply interested in forcing you to obey the arbitration system that you set up. That is called a neutral enforcement of a contract, and therefore they're going to force you to do that. Okay, now, there. I'm sorry, yeah.
So if someone gets married in Israel and then makes a Yerida,
yeah,
is it still enforceable, like a get would be enforced here or by the laws of whatever country?
No. Basically, if both parties left Israel, then Israel is out of the picture. Now, if the woman still lives in Israel and the husband made Yerida, she is able to institute a proceeding here. But the problem is, how are you going to enforce it against the husband? Now, the one thing that she can do is, she can ensure that if the husband ever comes back to Israel, she can have his passport confiscated, mm-hmm, and perhaps even imprisoned. But as long as he stays out of the country, the U.S. is not going to extradite the person. Meaning, she can open up the procedure, she can get an order, she can get everything. But he's in the U.S., so what's going to happen? So he will not be extradited for not giving a get. And unfortunately, the United States does not go that far. So I would have to say that she can go through the procedure, but it's not going to help her very much necessarily. In fact, the State Department issued an advisory once. It's a funny thing. You know, the State Department tells you where to travel, where not to travel. They said, it's crazy, they once said, any husband who has not given his wife a religious divorce is advised not to travel to Israel, because they will take away your passport. I don't know why they're giving advice to people. I guess they have to protect U.S. citizens no matter what. Okay, now, there is a part two to the agreement, which has nothing to do with part one. It's a separate thing. And part two is based on the following consideration. We know that one of the obligations of a husband to a wife under the ksuva is the marital contract, is that the husband is supposed to support his wife. The husband is obligated to support his wife with food, shelter, clothing. Now, you may ask me as an aside, hey, what do you mean husband is supposed to support his wife? What about the idea of kolel, where the wife supports the husband? Is that a violation of the ksuva? Right, that's the answer. The answer is it is a violation of the ksuva, but a woman is perfectly free to agree, and there are good reasons to agree, without getting into whether kolel should be permanent or not permanent. But, you know, this is building a Torah house, and this is enabling the husband to become a Talmud Chacham, etc. But, in terms of right, the woman has the right at any point to say, get a job and support me. That is her right under the ksuva. So, that right exists until a get is delivered, even after a civil divorce, theoretically. If a man got a civil divorce, but he didn't give a get, he is still halachically obligated to support his wife in the manner to which she is accustomed. We're not talking about bread and water, whatever the manner to which she's accustomed. So, in part two of the RCA agreement, they simply put a dollar amount there. And they basically say that for every day that we are living apart, I, meaning husband, will agree to pay my wife, and then you pick a number, but it can't be too high because then it looks like a fake number. But it has to be a reasonable connection to support. $300 a day or $1,000 a week for food, shelter, and clothing, to be terminated upon the delivery of a get. Now, what that does is, that creates an incentive to give a get, because his liability will keep on getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger until he gives a get. In other words, this is essentially quantification of a support obligation. Now, the advantage of part two is, now this is subtle, if I'm not being too much of a lawyer here, part two does not require a Beis Din getting involved at all. See, part one only means a Beis Din will order to give a get, so then he has to keep it. But let's say, you know, she can't get a Beis Din to order it. As I say, it's not easy. But this is a totally separate mechanism. This simply is, okay, the Beis Din is not going to order one way or the other. But you got to pay your husband. Husband has to pay his wife $350 a day until he gives a get as support. So he'll want to give a get to get out. You see, this does not depend on Beis Din at all. This is simply a support agreement. And halachically, you're obligated to pay support until you give a get. Now here, the only trick is, if the dollar amount is too high, it doesn't look like support, it's a fake, and you know that's why it has to be properly adjusted in a good way. So this is part one and part two. By the way, part two would work even in Israel. Part two would be useful even in Israel. Part one is not needed in Israel, because part one, the legal system already creates the obligation to go to Beis Din and listen. Okay, so in the United States, when the bride and the groom, when the chasna and the kala, sign a prenuptial, they can either sign one without two, or two without one, or they can sign one and two. Most of the time they sign one and two. There's also a part three which deals with how do you divide property. That has nothing to do with the get. That's really a separate aspect of the agreement. Now, some rabbis say that this is I mentioned three views. It's absolutely necessary. They will not marry a couple unless the couple agrees to sign this agreement, because they do not want to have a situation where a woman might be held hostage to an unreasonable husband. They want a situation where the husband agrees ahead of time to go to a Beis Din as an arbitration agreement, and that the husband will pay X amount of money every day he does not give a get. Okay, so they insist. Now, some rabbis are against this agreement. Now, why would you be against this agreement? Well, part A, there's no possible reason to be against part A, but they're against part B, because they basically say that without a psak Beis Din, you're not supposed to be forced to give a get. Right? Force is only permissible after a psak Beis Din, and they look at this money as kind of a coercive mechanism, and they are against it. On the other hand, I don't think that's a good argument, because this is not coercion. This is simply a recognition of a support obligation. Right? That's the issue.
He's obligated anyway.
He's obligated anyway, but not in that particular amount. Okay. Yeah. Okay. But unfortunately, there were recently some rabbis in Israel who actually came out against the prenuptial agreement, calling it a coercive get without a Beis Din. Okay. Now, people like me are... Yeah.
But then, isn't that the lesser of two evils, then, if you have a malicious man or a man who refuses to give a get, and you're providing a way to... Essentially, it's just a way to protect a woman. Either way, the man could get out of this, la-di-da, however he feels.
That's correct.
But a woman would be trapped. So would you not want to provide legal measures which are to protect a woman?
We certainly want to do it. But again, you have a problem. You have to be sure that you're not creating what we call a refua, a cure, that is worse than the illness. Because remember, a get that is procured through invalid coercion is a pasul get, which results in adultery and mamzer. So sometimes, therefore, people are extra meticulous to be sure that the get will be kosher. Mm-hmm. And if it's a mechanism that may produce a non-kosher get, that's even worse than not having a get at all. At least if a woman doesn't have a get at all, you know, she's not going to get married and have mamzerim. So that's the concern. The concern is maybe an over-conscientiousness not to have a get that's an invalid
get. Would a get not be possible if a man was thrown in jail from the Israeli government?
Oh, no, different. Yeah, 100% correct. The difference is, once you have a decision of a Beis Din, then coercion is legitimated.
See, that, that's, if they proceed to without...
That's correct. That's why hiring goons to beat up a guy is perfectly halachically okay once there's a psak beis din. If you did the same thing without a psak beis din, the get would be invalid. That's a very, very critical distinction that a lot of people, a lot of writers don't get. They all say, why can't you just beat up the guy? Well, if you have a psak beis din, you can. If you don't have a psak beis din, the get is no good. So the problem with two under this reading is it is coercion without a beis din decision. But the counter argument, which I think is the correct argument, is this is not coercion. This is just recognition of what he has to pay anyway, his duty of support. Okay, alrighty. Now, how do I explain my pariv? Right, I'm pariv, right? I say, well, if you want to do it, that's fine, but I don't insist on it. Well, the reason I don't insist on it is that, and maybe you'll say this is not right, but there are some rabbis who feel that we don't want to interject in a marriage ceremony thoughts of divorce and thoughts of lack of shalom bayis. It's kind of spiritually, it's bringing a little bit of what's called an ayin hara. Now again, you know, you might say, well, maybe the problem of aguna is serious enough that we ought to do that anyway. But some feel that the holiness of a marriage is so great that we don't want to bring any negativity and spirit of dissension within it. But there are different views about this. But as I say, if you were to ask me, but again, obviously, whichever rabbi is going to marry you, he is the one that you have to check with because he will make the decision. But if you were to ask me if such an agreement is permissible, I would certainly say that it is. I wouldn't say you have to do it, but it is permissible. And as I say, part one would not be necessary in Israel. Part two would be helpful even in Israel. Yeah.
Why do you think it's even necessary that they keep the get? In nowadays, in general,
keep it
part of the ketuvah and everything.
I know what you mean. Keep the get.
Like why sustain this tradition?
Oh, why have the ritual of get?
Yeah, well, nowadays.
Well, among other things, it's one of the 613 commandments. It's in the Torah itself. It's not made up by the rabbis.
Wow.
It's in the book of Deuteronomy. That a man shall give his wife a document of separation. So it's a doraisa. We cannot compromise on the... I mean, I gave you ways that you could avoid a get through annulment and the like, but you can't just get rid of the get. The get is part and parcel. By the way, there was a proposal, by the way, in Morocco in the 19th century that maybe the way we'll solve aguna, let's get rid of marriage. Nobody should get married. They actually talked about... they talked about reinstituting all relationships as mistresses, as concubines, and we would have economic protections for them, and you wouldn't need a get because there would just be no marriage at all. Nobody would get married at all, but they would live out of everything would be out of wedlock.
Seems like that misses the main point of Judaism.
This is similar to I think killing mosquitoes with atom bomb. I mean. Aguna is a serious problem. But when all is said and done, I mean, it is a serious problem. You are dealing with a small number of women. And to abolish marriage for Klal Yisrael because of a small number of women that are suffering would seem to be a very, very extreme thing to destroy. I mean, you're talk about throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, you're destroying marriage because a certain small percentage of marriages have these very, very bad, tragic outcomes. Okay, so we'll stop here. I do have probably another 20 minutes next week, so I hope I'll just tell the student to come late next week. Because I want to talk about some secular laws of the state of New York that deal specifically with aguna. It's very, very unusual for a secular law to actually talk about agunos, but New York State... because of so many religious Jews, actually has two laws, and the New York laws were copied by Great Britain and by Ontario province in Canada and by South Africa. So there are, throughout different places in the world, some secular laws that protect agunot, But the problem is, the secular laws raise halachic problems. So there are some poskim who say that the secular laws will actually produce invalid halachic gets. So we'll talk about that next week. Okay. You all have a good evening, good Shabbos, and be well.